Welcome to Uncover the Human, where every conversation revolves around enhancing all the connections in our lives.
Whether that's with our families, coworkers, or even ourselves.
When we can be our authentic selves, magic happens.
This is Christina Amigoni.
And this is Alex Cullimore.
Let's dive in.
Authenticity means freedom.
Authenticity means going with your gut.
Authenticity is bringing 100% of yourself, not just the parts you think people want to see, but all of you.
Being authentic means that you have integrity to yourself.
It's the way our intuition is whispering something deep-rooted and true.
Authenticity is when you truly know yourself. You remember and connect to who you were before others told you who you should be.
It's transparency, relatability, no frills, no makeup, just being.
Welcome back to this episode of Uncover the Human. Today, it's just Christina and I. We're back to just the pair of us for today. We wanted to talk about a topic that's always on everybody's mind, whether they address it immediately or not, and that is ambiguity. There is a lot of that going on in the world right now.
Yes, we are definitely living it. And we actually started by picking a podcast topic and then talking about ambiguity and switching over to ambiguity. So this is what living in ambiguity and keeping cool looks like.
Well, we'll see if we keep cool. We're going to find out that along the way.
It's like we throw curveballs to ourselves just to dance around and see what happens.
Got to practice somehow. We can't throw ourselves off. What are we doing? If you think about ambiguity, I mean, a couple of things come to mind. First, there's like the economic ambiguity right now. We've watched three different banks collapse or get absorbed in the last few months. People whisper about things like recessions. There's no real recession, but there's lots of things like layoffs in the tech industry going on right now. We're facing current ambiguity within Siamo of like, what are the next things we're going to do? So let's talk a little bit about, I don't know, any of these. Where do you want to start, Christina?
Yeah, you just took all the known things out of my mind. So I'm going to go back.
And then I tossed it right to you. You're welcome.
Exactly. So, okay, hold on. Let me turn around, open it yet another ambiguous door of what am I supposed to say now? Yeah, it is. It's very difficult. I mean, if we think about it and we break it down, we live in ambiguity every day, all day. From something even as simple, depending on the definition of simple and what's going on, as the weather. Like it's raining, like if we were in winter in the Northeast right now in Colorado, which is very different. And part of that ambiguity is because we are used to sun and we are used to blue skies, is when is the rain going to end? And yes, we have apps and we have all those things, but it's still not enough to really, the mind and the heart around ambiguity don't really communicate well. There's some communication breakdown. So yes, my mind knows that I can look at AccuWeather and say like, oh, it's going to rain until tomorrow. Great. My heart is like, is it over? Is it over? Is it over? When are we done yet?
Yeah, it's just two important points. There's the feeling we have going into it of the unknown. And then the secondary thing that can create ambiguity is those expectations, right? We kind of expect things to be sunny. It's very weird, especially in Colorado, to have a particularly rainy day that might usually rain will last at most an hour. Now we have like 2 days straight of rain. That's odd. That's unpredictable. Even the apps will tell you that it's going to rain. And then half the time that's not true. And so like that expectations management ends up becoming a really important part of ambiguity, I think, in general. And that's where things start to spin out. You know, when people whisper about recessions or we see banks disappearing or we see the weather changing on us, like part of the frustration and part of the loss is because we have a certain set of expectations that something else might happen, or we hope that something else might happen. And so there's kind of that grieving loss of the change in expectations of here's what I thought was going to happen, here's the future I thought was going to be, and that's not going to be. Now it's something else. Now it's when it's undefined and it's particularly ambiguous, I think that becomes particularly difficult for people to wrestle with.
Yeah, it is. And we actually talk about this. We have a lesson on it in our leadership development program about getting comfortable with ambiguity, or at least embracing ambiguity. I don't know that we can ever get comfortable with it. We're always going to be fighting the unknown and the darkness of it. But we can definitely embrace ambiguity as a part of life and figure out what is it that we need to remain calm in it. Because panicking for every single ambiguous thing makes for a very stressful life. And so, yes, there are moments to panic. And that doesn't mean that panic should be repressed. One of the examples I actually used in our training program a couple of weeks ago was the ambiguity I had to live through while looking for a parking spot, mind you, during a recession at the airport that was saying there were spots open, but I couldn't find a single one of them for over 45 minutes. And so the ambiguous, I had a full on just hyperventilating, almost panic attack. So I had to stop the car, not drive in it, and figure out what is it that's causing me anxiety. Because the ambiguity, I can't do anything about. I'm going to have to keep circling and finding a parking spot or come up with other ways to be able to make my plane. So what is it that I'm attached to? What is that expectation that now has thrown such a huge curveball that I can't even focus and think straight or drive for a couple of seconds? And so I realized that my attachment was to making my flight. And knowing that, as I always do at the airport, I park fairly quickly and then I go through security and I let whatever time goes by, but I expect that to go within a certain time limit. And I'm at the gate with at least an hour to go before I board. And this was all getting thrown out. Spending 45 minutes for looking for a parking space was not part of the plan or the expectation. And so I had to kind of look at the list. I'm like, I'm attached to making my flight. And so I had to let that go and figure out, like, okay, what happens? Worst case scenario, what happens if I miss my flight? And I'm spending 2 hours looking for a parking spot. I am going to find a parking spot, even if I have to go to some of the faraway parking lots. But what is it? That's one. I'm like, okay, I can let go of that. I can catch the next flight. I can catch flights tomorrow. It's okay. It's not the end of the world. Second one was there was supposed to be a snowstorm coming, at least in Castle Rock, that was forecasted for 12 inches of snow. So part of my expectations and attachment was to park in the garage so I wouldn't have to dig my car out when we landed 4 days later. And I had to let that go. That was a hard one. And part of letting that go was thinking like, well, I'm traveling with Alex and Kelly. So if there are 12 inches of snow coming and I have to park outside, they'll help me dig out the car. And so once I let go of those two plans I had in my mind on how my travel to the airport was going to go, started breathing again, opened up my options on where to find parking spot. And I did end up going to an outside space where it was still hard to find one, but I did find one. And then I made my flight and I had plenty of time at the gate and it didn't snow. So none of my worst case prediction came to fruition. However, the ambiguity is what was paralyzing because I was so attached to the way I wanted things to go.
Yeah, that's a great example. I think air travel in general will introduce ambiguity in anyone's life. You know that you have to get to the airport. You know you have to maybe check a bag. You have no idea what the line's going to be like there. You have no idea what the line's going to be like at security. You have no idea whether the plane's going to be there when you get there. There's just 10,000 different unknowns between you and a destination. And it brings up, when you talk about all the attachments to the things, I think the sneaky part about attachment is it creeps up on us like so many assumptions in our heads. Like we don't necessarily even know consciously, unless we're really, really paying attention all the time to everything we're attaching to. It can be very easy just to get attached to an outcome or how you think something is going to go and be entirely thrown without even really knowing why, because it's more subconscious, that attachment to here's how it's going to look, here's how it's going to be, here's what we're going to do. And it sneaks up on us the way like we make assumptions about other people, or we make assumptions about situations, and then sometimes are proven wrong or proven right. And we sometimes pat ourselves on the back knowing that we were right in the assumptions, but regardless, there's tends to be some subconscious processing that gets us there, that we end up with a bunch of attachments that we weren't consciously making, but now we're kind of bound by, and we have to consciously work our way out of when they start to bind us. And we're circling around that parking lot and like, yep, here's the 98 attachments that are currently being strained by this current event.
Yeah, it's so true. Like we have all these attachments based on past experience, based on what's important to us, based on habit, you name it, whatever it is. And letting those go, it's really hard. One thing that I found myself reminding, or I guess getting comfortable with when embracing ambiguity, is switching the attachments. So what if my attachments are not about external circumstances, which I can't control? I can't control the economy. I can't control the weather. I can't control 4,000 people, or probably 400,000 people parking at an airport during a recession. We can't control layoffs. We can't control all these other things. But what can I control? And what I can control is what I believe myself to be able to get through. And so do I believe that I will figure it out? Yes, I can attach to that. Because then whatever it is, well, I can figure it out. And so I'm not now attached to a certain outcome. I'm not attached to whatever I thought the plan was going to be or how it was going to turn out. Can I believe in, you know, in my friends and the support of the community that I work with? Yes, I can actually attach to that because no matter what happens, there is going to be support, at least with trusting connections and deep connections. And so those are the things to switch to. And once we switch, where our heart can switch to those because our heart understands what happens in those, then you can, it's easier to let go. It's easier to say, yeah, there, you know, the economy is the way it is and we'll know what to do because we've figured it out so far, figured it out in the past 48 years. We'll figure it out so far.
No, that's a great way of putting it. And that's a great way of prioritizing where to attach. I mean, attach first and foremost to the things you can control yourself. That's always the only thing you can ultimately attach to. Yeah. And secondarily, yes, absolutely. If you invested time in a really good community, you can count on that to be around too. So you can count on some support there. You know, you'll be able to turn and you'll know you'll have the support of people when they can help and assist, and then letting go of the things we can't attach to. Those are huge. And the other thing that I would say is kind of like the tertiary thing you can connect to, and this one these are getting more and more external and a little bit more out of our control, is things like the eventual goal and outcome. If you think about your plane travel, you want to get to the destination. That's the eventual goal, is I'm going to end up in X city. And usually there's some kind of timeline on that. Like, I want to get there before, you know, whatever starts. Is it the program we're starting? Mm-hmm. Is it a vacation? I want to get there before the next plane we have to take or whatever it is. There might be a timeline on that. So it's a little more out of your control. But when you focus on the outcome there, you have a chance to absorb the inevitable ambiguous roadblocks along the way. Like, oh, the bathrooms aren't open in this terminal. Okay, well, we're going to have to figure that one out. Okay, there's no food on this side. Okay, let's go figure that out. Or still the goal is the same. The goal is, hey, we're going to get to Dallas or whatever it is. And that means, you know, if you have to take a different flight, you have to take a different flight. You might have to take a different connection. You have to check a bag, not check a bag. Whatever the options are along the way, having a focus on the end goal and an attachment to yourself and your own resiliency are two really powerful ways to kind of keep yourself motivated when everything's a little bit in the fog. Mm-hmm.
You know, and that doesn't mean that we should eliminate the feelings we have in those panic moments. Again, it's not about repressing the panic and never panicking or not getting angry or not getting depressed. Whenever the curveball comes, big or small, we have to live those feelings. They're part of who we are. We are emotional beings who occasionally think. So letting the emotions go through, but those emotions, it's interesting because once we let them be and we actually feel them and almost focus into them, we can figure out, if I am pissed off, scared, depressed, what was I attached to that's not happening or that's happening differently? They can be the indication. That's the data, like Susan David says. That's the data to indicate that there's something important there that's being challenged. And so use the emotion, go through them, and then also realize, hey, now I can use this. The one thing about the emotions we don't like, I wouldn't call them negative, they're just emotions. So the emotions that we don't like to feel is that they can be fueling. They can turn around and you can find energy into them, especially if you can start believing, I will figure it out. It will be fine. I have survived. I've seen this quote many times. I have survived 100% of the days and of the things that happened to me so far. So still here, still survived. Will it be the way I wanted it to be? No. Will it be pleasant? Sometimes yes, sometimes horribly not. But we'll survive it.
That's a really good point. I think you have to feel those things, because otherwise you can, you know, double your energy output and try and push those things down.
Yes.
Spend a bunch of time telling yourself you shouldn't be stressed out about it, you shouldn't do this. Or you use it as the understanding and you can redirect that too. That's one line of research has been kind of, I've been discovering lately. I don't think it's super recent, but it's new to me. The idea that anxiety and excitement are actually very similar physical sensations. And so when you're feeling very anxious, very nervous about something, even just telling yourself, no, I'm pretty excited about this opportunity. If you're nervous about, you know, how a presentation is going to go or something, telling yourself you're excited for the opportunity to do it can redirect the already existing energy in your body of, hey, I'm feeling anxious, to excitement, because your body doesn't really know the difference. It's a very similar physiological response. We're in both cases in an aroused state and in a much more alert state, but we can direct that towards a more, for lack of a better term, positive or negative psychology, depending on how we invest in it.
Yeah, that's very true. You know, and again, that doesn't mean that we should create ambiguity when it's not necessary. We can learn to embrace it, and we can learn to be comfortable with the feeling of ambiguity and our journey through it. But, you know, unless you're like us, it may not be a good hobby to just create ambiguity for the sake, you know, for the hell of it, and see what happens to people when you do that. So I think it's still a good practice to try and minimize the ambiguity, because there's so much. There's so much ambiguity we go through every single day. Personal, work life, other life, weather, you name it. Aging, gray hair, anything, everything is ambiguous. So if we could reduce, especially in the organizations, the ambiguity for our people, they would actually spend more time doing what they're supposed to be doing and be productive and engaged, rather than spinning and trying to get out of multiple panic moments that could have been prevented with things like communication, clarity, structure.
And even saying, you know, communicating out that you don't know where things are going to go yet is better communication than no communication. Because no communication, everyone fills in the story exactly how they want it. And by how they want it, I mean the natural human bias towards the most negative possible interpretation of the story. So that is where people are going to go. So in an organization, even if you can't provide perfect clarity, even saying like, we're still working on this, or here's what we're considering, or here's the reality of the situation, and we're still, even it's a great opportunity to solicit ideas from teams too, but it's a chance to just tell people, yeah, we're working through this, with rather than just holding back until you have a plan. Because the longer you hold back, and the longer you hold back on communicating anything, the more spun out people get, and the longer it's going to take to wrangle them back in when you do have a more definitive message you can give.
Yeah, indeed. You know, and as leaders, I think it's very common to think that as soon as we get the title or the team in the org chart reporting to us, we also somehow get permanently certified as chief solution officers. That's not our job. It doesn't mean we have to have all the answers. It's okay to say, I don't know. It's okay to just say, hey, here's all the information. I have no idea what this means for the future. I have no idea how things will plan out. I don't even know what to do with the information yet, but here's all the information. Because like you said, there are some seriously dark movies in people's heads when the opposite is silence.
I see it going on with the economy alone. Like, you just see a couple bumps, and then people start doing things like layoffs. And was that necessary? Maybe, maybe not. But when it starts to catch on, like this weird contagion where other people start to do like layoffs. Yes. Was it necessary? Was it necessary to start this and ironically create weird conditions that you were worried about might happening? It's an interesting exercise in global manifestation.
yeah talk about self-fulfilling
market
prophecy.
Manifestation.
You know, there's I'm sure that there are times in the economy where it is actually no I'm gonna take that back and I'm not an economist so this is definitely my completely biased opinion on a soapbox, but given that humans are the ones that create economy, humans are the ones that make it hard and destroy it. So it is actually up to us. There is no third outside somehow divine intervention that makes the economy go up or down. We do it. We do it to ourselves. And so what's happening now, it's you know, it's some of that. It's like, it's really hard to believe that there's a recession when you can't find a parking spot at any hours of the day, of any day of the week at the airport, where there's literally more people than I've ever seen, even on like the week before Christmas, anytime, 3 a.m. And we've done that thanks to delayed flights. And so recession, really, apparently there's money. Somebody's spending money, because these flights are not free. Actually, they're probably twice as expensive as they used to be even 6 months ago. Restaurants is the same thing. It's impossible to get a seat in a restaurant. So you have to make reservation weeks or days in advance. Then you can only go at, you know, 10:15 a.m. on the Tuesday after Labor Day to be able to get a seat. So money is out there. People are spending money. They may not be spending it in the same way that they were before pre-pandemic. Maybe it's not on things and it's on experiences. And there's also the bubble of the gigantic hiring that happened during the pandemic, that now it's being regulated through, unfortunately, massive layoffs. But those are all things that we do. The humans do. Again, no, there's not somebody from Mars or somebody from a different galaxy that comes in and just switches the dial on the economy. So what if we actually took responsibility for how we react to rumors, to feelings, to fears, to the ambiguity, and how we actually do make it a self-fulfilling prophecy because of the actions that the humans do and therefore the economy responds to.
Yeah, you kind of think of it like a school of fish. Like they all are reacting to the movements of everything around them. So if you take that half moment to change your reaction and be like, hey, I don't think this is actually a shark coming our way, and you don't swim, other people also end up following that. I mean, we have a little control in our own destiny, even if the destiny becomes attached to the larger group. So it is incumbent on all of us to have some of that responsibility to take which means taking a flyer on our gut instinct and saying, yeah, I don't know that this is the time to jump or freak out. And you can still do things with precautions, and you don't have to stand against the crowd all the time. It's not like there aren't dangers out there, but it's worth a little investigation, and it takes some guts to hold to your convictions and be like, yeah, I don't think this is the right move just because everybody seems to be moving right now.
Well, and to hold to some critical thinking, because that's the thing. It's, it's also for lack of better words, almost a laziness in critical thinking. Is like, is this necessary or is it necessary to go through this? And maybe it is. And in a lot of cases, I'm not saying that every company is out there laying people off when they shouldn't or they don't need to. But there are different ways of looking at things. There are, like Simon Sinek talks about it in The Infinite Game, those parameters that companies come up with, which are completely random. And again, human created. There's no master plan anywhere that tells you that these are the numbers you have to hit every quarter. And that's when you have to hit them and how you have to hit them. That's all human created, man-made. And so those are the things that, where's the critical thinking? You know, like just because we're cutting costs by laying a bunch of people off, is that really the first solution, the only solution? Is that all we're going to think about? Maybe there's a million other ways. And in the 2008 recessions, there are tons of examples of company that didn't just jump on the bandwagon because it was, panic moment. This is how you do it. This is how you cut costs, is you cut people. Right. And then you hire them back at a premium 2 years later or 10 months later when humans turned the economy around. So how did that work out on your numbers from a long-term perspective?
But at least you shot morale in the foot.
Exactly. Look at productivity. I was reading an article yesterday on how productivity is the lowest. It keeps dipping. And so it keeps getting lower and lower and lower every year. And no, it's not about the working from home. but it's just the overall insecurity and ambiguity and engagement. And also, honestly, people knowing that they don't matter. In a good number of companies, they don't matter because the arbitrary quarter number matters way more, which could probably be saved by using one ply toilet paper for a month. Who knows? But that's the thing, like, where's the creativity of that?
Let's go straight to people, which is the most delicate and one of the worst places to cut. I mean, it's not saying that you never have to. It's just when you do that, you inevitably cause all the ripple effects. And it's much harder. You want people to be, it's always difficult, I find, to look at companies demanding loyalty and saying people just don't want to work for companies. They're not going to stick around. And then turning around and firing a third of their staff. I'm like, well, okay, this is a two-way street. You don't get to ask for loyalty in one way. And then like, well, but it's inconvenient for us now. So you're out the door.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, and that's it. And I know Simon talks about that in The Infinite Game as well. It's just kind of like, it doesn't work that way. You can't complain about people not showing up to the office when then you turn around and lay off at the first sign of like, oh, we're not making our quarter number. Go, people, first, move. You're not moving fast enough. Out the door.
We're a family. Okay. Just like your family, we will be getting rid of the low performers.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It just doesn't work that way. There's critical thinking. We all have it. It is a capacity of all our human brains. It's not just for the select few. But let's communicate. Let's find ways. Let's figure it out. And yes, sometimes it does end up that some people may have to go. But is it? Why is it a plan A as opposed to plan three alphabets over? Because we've tried everything else first.
I think it's funny that you mentioned things like the ambiguous quarterly numbers that people bring up. Like Simon Sinek likes to bring that up. We just created some quarterly numbers. And then, even if you don't make the number, it doesn't even mean that you didn't make money. It's just you didn't make what you thought you might be able to make. So it's funny when we talk about ambiguity and we talk about like creating clarity. It sounds like a clear goal when you're like, we're going to get to X amount of revenue. And yet that is ambiguous. It's not really within your control. It can be something you aim for, but does it actually mean you didn't perform when you don't get there? Mm-hmm. We're working with a software company that had to do some massive migration, and they were using it on Azure. And for a little while, one of the Microsoft services slowed down. So you're working with cloud services. Occasionally, some things are slower. Does that mean the team failed? Does that mean they couldn't make their exact deadline? Did they do something wrong? No. You still have the same goal. You still have the same performance, and it was out of their control. This is why contracts have the force majeure clause, where it's like, yeah, we do have the ability to change this contract if there's acts of God and crazy things that happen. Yes. We do assume that is out there, and yet we set these arbitrary goals. We're like, I can't believe we didn't make it. That's ridiculous.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and I'm surprised those contracts haven't been changed to the act of economy instead of act of God. It's apparently, it's a totally external being that's controlling our fate here on the financial side of things. But it's true. Like, we actually, I've been meaning to talk about it and also to share that Yanis, and I'm not going to attempt to say his last name is on a podcast video, where he pushes back on a reporter saying, hey, so did you consider this season a failure? Because whatever team he's playing on, which I also did not look it up, so I don't remember where it is.
Top-notch, you know, basketball facts.
You know, didn't make it to the playoffs or didn't make it past the first series of the playoffs, whatever the story is, which clearly, I love ambiguity enough that I don't actually have to get the facts to tell the story. But the core of it, what I really wanted to get to, is the fact that he looks at the reporter and he's like, you know what? You asked me the same question last year. It's the wrong question. It's like, it's not a failure just because we are not winning the championship. You can't look at it that way. There's no failure in sports. Did we try? Yes. Did we try our best? Yes. Did we try our semi-best? Yes. Then it was a success. We can't win the championship every single time. You know, he uses Michael Jordan as an example. The Chicago Bulls won 16, you know, like he played for 16 seasons and they won 9. So are the others a failure? No, of course not. Because not everybody wins every single time. If the measure of success is having a trophy as the winning. So what if success, what if winning is a different definition than having a trophy or a ring that you bring home?
That's a great way of looking at it. And I have seen that clip floating around. It's a great interview. I would absolutely recommend that to anybody who hasn't seen it yet. It's very powerful. And I like the idea of like using that as a sports team. Is that you think about like seasons, you can think about that and make the metaphor of like business quarters. Like we all decide that this quarter is where this goal ends or whatever, which is even more arbitrary if you think about it. We just determined like this 3 month period is the important one. Anyway, that's a total side topic, but that's a different level of ambiguity. But you can't, like, if a team is working its way up, let's say it has a hard season or, you know, a good bunch of good players retired and or whatever it is, it's traded away. And now they have, you know, you have to work your way back up, become a cohesive team, et cetera. There's progress being made each season as you work towards hopefully eventually getting to a trophy. It's not to say you shouldn't chase those. You shouldn't be looking for the trophies. But if you took like 4 seasons to get up to it, are all of those failures or each of those better than the last? And you could never get to the one where you actually win it without having those first 4. And so that short-sighted perspective of it's only just about like the ring this year, which I'm not saying, again, you shouldn't chase that. But the second that's over, then it's only a success if you get it again the next year. It's only a success if you get it again the next year. It's like, where does the train end and what is the actual measure of success there? And how do you account for improvements? If you've got, I don't actually know how many NBA teams there are, but I'm going to assume there's at least 30. Yeah, so there's 30 of them, like, out
32,
there.
29
that don't make it. Yeah, sounds about right. So 31 teams are failures every season. I mean, yeah, they didn't win the championship, but each one is making a stronger stride, changing the game a little bit, doing something new, trying a new tactic, having a new team bonding, whatever it is that drives that continued success and gets them towards another. The goal still might be winning trophies, but you still have to get the progress to get there. Is it a failure if you're still walking towards that? If you're still in the right path? Even if you can't see the path.
Which, you know, sometimes we can. Or we lay out the path and then it's... What we are guaranteed is that it's not going to go the way we expected. So there is one thing that is not ambiguous.
You can be totally sure of.
Is that we will always be met with ambiguity. And ambiguity is the only place, really, that we have to go. It's the only place where we learn. Because we don't learn when we know everything already. And it's the only place where things move. We evolve every day. Every day is different. Everything we do is different. And the only way that happened is because the moment that is about to be in front of us, it's ambiguous. That's it. It's never certain. There's nothing certain.
Yeah, and as much as I know everybody loves a good probability question, this is actually mathematically proven as well, that you can't predict something on a continuous scale. You can never be 100%. You'll never, almost assuredly, you can't. There's a 0% chance of you predicting it right. If you think about every single number between 0 and 1, and I mean every single one, every possible combination of decimals between 0 and 1, there are infinite numbers between those two. So if I asked you to pick one, and whether it was the quote there with the one I picked or something, there is a 1 over infinity chance that you pick that one, at which point that is actually 0. So you're over infinity, it's 0. So there's no chance which guarantees that whatever you predict of the future, it will not be exactly that. You can get close. You might be near. That's great. It's not saying you can't predict these things, but the idea that it's only right if you get it 100% right, well, you're guaranteeing yourself you're going to be disappointed.
Indeed. Yeah. And there you go. You've used your math theory degree. That's an ambiguous thing you went into.
Very ambiguous.
And you just create a certainty over it for a second.
That was very ambiguous why I got that in the first place. And now we're here. I guess this was the reason.
And how you would use it. And yet it keeps coming up.
That's good. Actually, just as a closing thought, it's an interesting idea because I didn't know how that was going to apply. I didn't know what it was going to be. But because it's knowledge that's in my head somewhere rattling around, it ends up inevitably coloring the context of how I see the world. So that's why I end up with an analogy like here. Is it the perfect analogy? Is it one that makes sense to everybody? Hopefully it makes sense enough. But regardless, it's just my context in the world. And that's always going to be colored by that. And it's not right or wrong. It's just what it is. And so it was still not right or wrong to have gone through and gotten to have received a math degree. But it ended up being used in different ways. I could never have predicted how it's going to apply. But it will also color your experience. So, take all of it with a grain of salt, understand whatever is happening and use it in the larger context. Save yourself the pain of thinking it has to mean something immediately.
Yes. Yeah. Or that you know where the path is just because you have that. We don't know where the path goes. We know how we can deal with the path and what we bring to the path. So spend time and energy figuring that out, because that's the only thing that we can count on is how am I going to deal with the path?
Yeah. There's a good quote that I will paraphrase because I don't know the exact one, but it's a person can never
research
stand in the same
before
river.
We get on. We do these.
We're just going ambiguous all the way down today. The quote is that a person can never stand in the same river because it's not the same river and they're not the same person. So even if you're at the same place, everything has flowed past. You're a different person. You're a different experience. You can feel that even if you watch the same TV show twice, you're going to see something entirely different in it because you're a different person.
I know. I'm on my fifth time watching the whole Suits season. And there's things I never noticed the first 5 times. So the whole Suits series. So yeah, definitely. Great quote. So go.
So embracing ambiguity.
Embrace ambiguity. Find yourselves in the dark fog of ambiguity. That's the only light.
Yeah. Attach to yourself. It's the only thing you can count on.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening to Uncover the Human, a Siamo podcast.
Special thanks to our podcast operations wizard, Jake Lara, and our score creator, Rachel Sherwood.
If you have enjoyed this episode, please share, review, and subscribe. You can find our episodes wherever you listen to podcasts.
We would love to hear from you with feedback, topic ideas, or questions. You can reach us at podcast@wearesiamo.com or at our website, wearesiamo.com, LinkedIn, Instagram, or Facebook. We Are Siamo is spelled WEARESIAMO.
Until next time, listen to yourself, listen to others, and always uncover the human.